I'm backstage and I just decided to have a sip of water and I discovered I had a drinking problem. I poured water all over myself back there. I'm just thinking, I'm not sure how that's going to look when I walk out here. So like I'm drooling all over myself, you know. This guy's got something to say. Anyway, hey, welcome. It's good to see you. I'm sorry I got distracted there just for a moment. I'm excited to move further in the story of David. Hopefully you're enjoying the story. Hopefully you're finding great application for your life personally. If you're new to the church or missed a couple Sundays, then I'll encourage you to download the MyNPC app. You can watch the videos right there online. You can listen to them in your car. It's a listen option or a watch option, depending on whether you're using data or driving or how you're going to do that. But we want you to encourage you to do that and also use the Go Deeper supplementals so that you can take this message further and deeper inside your family and inside your life and your small group or personal devotions. And so you'll find this week's Go Deeper, again, in the app. And you can also go on the website and you can print it there as well. So whatever is easiest for you to do, we encourage you to do that. So I want you to get your pen and paper out here, your message guide. I'm going to give you six words. And I want you to write these words down because throughout today's message, these six words have huge implication. And they're just different emotions is actually what they are, different types of emotions in the way that we think. You're going to see today in this story, these emotions all come to play. But with these emotions, you're also going to see direct connections to us in our lives, of how they apply to us and how we need to safeguard ourselves from making some mistakes when we move into these emotional situations. So hopefully I've stalled enough for you and given you a chance to get out your pen and paper. Here are your six words. The first word is paranoia. Paranoia. Write that down somewhere on your message notes. Second is insecurity. Third is jealousy, anger, fear, and loneliness. Those are the six words. Again, paranoia, insecurity, jealousy, anger, fear, and loneliness. Those different elements, now, and you're going to see today in our message, you're going to see King Saul deal with some of these issues. You're going to see him with the paranoia, the insecurity, and the jealousy. It's going to rage in his life. And you're going to see King David, or now David, he's not king yet. You'll see David going through anger and fear, and loneliness, rejection. He's going to feel abandoned. And so these emotions play out in different ways. And some of this stuff cross-pollinates as well, and you'll be able to recognize that as we go through it. But why am I starting off with this? Because I want you to really pay attention to the connection that happens when we have big, strong emotions that crop up inside our lives. In a normal situation, when things are going relatively well inside your life, it is super easy for us to lean on the ways of God and the laws of God. They are satisfactory. They are helpful. They are encouraging. They're right. They're tested. They're true. When things are going well, it's so easy to follow after Jesus, right? Isn't it? It's just so easy to follow God's words and his precepts, his commands and his laws. But when things get bad, and we go through heavy emotional crisis in our life, there's this huge temptation. Our emotions taunt us and tempt us and try to draw us over the line, bait us over, if you will, into doing things that would take our situation into our own hands. Instead of trusting and relying on God and trusting that he is with us, there's something inside of us when we're facing these emotions specifically, these six, that suddenly we're faced with the fear that that this shouldn't be happening to me. And if it is happening to me, then God must not be with me. And so since God is not with me because these bad things are happening to me, then I'm going to take matters into my own hands. And what we hope would happen is that we'd make our lives less complicated. But unfortunately, we just make them more complicated. Instead of trying to make our lives less difficult in the moment, we, unfortunately, these things will oftentimes lead us to making our lives even more difficult. These emotions, paranoia, anger, jealousy, insecurity, fear, loneliness, all these things have the power to undermine the resolve of even the most devout and dedicated and disciplined person in this room. It just has the temptation and the power to crush through and push through every boundary that we've ever set up for ourselves. And we do things that we never thought that we would ever do relationally, financially, physically, morally. And chances are, here's the thing, chances are that one of these things was associated with something that you would say is your greatest regret. Chances are you made a decision, and these emotions were at play, one or two or many of them, and it's now a part of your story, and it's a part of your deepest regret. Unfortunately, for some of us, these will be part of our future story as well. And so it's important to know how to properly respond to this and learn from God's word so that we can do something about it. Because when we're faced with these emotions, there's something that happens in you and it happens in me. That when I feel like God's not with me, when I feel like he's left me and the bad things are happening to me, then I suddenly feel like I need to do something. Whatever I can do to break this tension. If it's to fight back, I'll fight back. If it's to give in, I'll give in. There's just something in us that seems to draw us and pull us in these ways. And so today we're going to see this story in the life of David. We're going to see it play out in Saul. And both these characters, through these emotions, are going to do things that they never expected that they would ever do. But for David, it will turn out to be his greatest regret. Now, we know the big sin that David has with Bathsheba. He does in his late 40s. We know that sin. We're going to preach about that, talk about that in the weeks to come. But before we get to that, if you were to pull David aside, probably in heaven, when you ever get a chance to meet him one day in eternity, and you would say, what's your greatest regret? I think he would point back to today's story. And it's a story that you don't hear preached off very often. It's a story that you may not have even known took place. But it was a moment when David was gripped by anger and by fear and felt lonely and abandoned and rejected. And it led to him doing some really foolish things. And it had a disastrous outcome. Before we get into the story, let me just kind of set some ground rules of what kind of where we were. Not kind of context, I guess. So David had just killed Goliath. He was 15 years old when he killed Goliath. And so little David out there, he's just all this confidence and courage, right? And he goes out in this field in the Valley of Elah, and he stands face to face with this giant. The giant taunts him, and he has this biggest, baddest speech ever. He says, oh yeah, you come at me, but I'm going to kill you. You think that, and I'm going to kill you in the name of the Lord of Heaven's armies. And I'm going to feed you and all your men to the beasts and birds of the air and the beasts of the field. But it's going to be this disastrous mess for you, and certainly exactly everything that David says would happen, including cutting off the head of the great giant. And when that happened, David quickly propelled into incredible fame. It catapulted him into being a national person. Everyone knew David. There was not anyone that didn't know who this little man was. And so here he was, 15 years old, the most famous person in the territory, and his fame and his influence and the relationships around him would just continue to climb. And we know that King Saul, unfortunately, was a paranoid leader. He was very insecure and very jealous. And the more that David grew in influence and relationship, all King Saul saw was that David was growing in power. And so Saul began to hate him more and more. Saul was very cynical of him. And then Saul would have moments where he'd like David because he was really a likable guy and he did everything that King Saul asked him to do. And so there was these moments where David was just like such a great subordinate person. He was just doing everything. But then there was times that King Saul was just suspicious and paranoid, and he would try to kill David. A couple times, David's playing the harp for him in the room, and King Saul just throws a spear at him a couple different occasions trying to kill him. How'd you like working for that guy? Maybe you do. You know, maybe you feel like, I am working for that guy. I don't know. He's not throwing spears at me, but I'm dodging bullets every day from this guy. This is what David's going through. And so King Saul has this plan. He says, I'm going to get David in my family, and maybe if I get him in my family, I can control him. And so he offers David his oldest daughter and says, hey, you can have her to be your wife, and then you'll be in the family. And then, of course, Jonathan is next in line for king, so you won't be the king. So I can kind of control the situation here. And David's like, no, I'm not worthy to be, you know, a part of the family, you know. And so, although, remember, he had been given the opportunity with a reward of killing Goliath to marry Saul's daughter, but he's like, I didn't do it for that reason. I did it for God's glory. But so I don't really thank you for the offer. And he respectfully declines the offer from Saul to marry his daughter. And so for 7 years, David comes in and out of Saul's favor. And Saul can't stand it because Saul eventually just wants the guy dead. And so he gives David these impossible missions. He sends him out to do these most impossible things. He gives him only a few men and this, a task that is just so big that no mortal person could ever defeat in this battle. And that's what he sends David into, these surely to lose types of battles. And you know what happened with David? We know. He comes back victorious, and his fame grows even more, and his popularity grows even more, and it begins to backfire even more and more on Saul, and his anger begins to climb more and more. Well, eventually, David would fall in love with one of Saul's other daughters, a girl by the name of Michal. And Saul saw that David loved her, and David wanted to marry her. And so in order to have her as a bride, Saul would again send him on a death mission, figuring there's no way he would be able to succeed. And he does. He succeeds again. So he has to give his daughter over to him. And then David builds a great relationship, a strong bond with Saul's son, Jonathan. They became just incredible close friends. And so now, so it's all backfiring, right? You seeing this? Saul wants to have David killed, but instead he continues to promote this guy and give him more opportunity for influence, power, fame, and all these things. And Saul, he just can't stand it. But what ended up happening, and I'm paraphrasing a lot that you're going to read this week in your Go Deeper. You're going to read several chapters where you'll see all these details. I'm just trying to get you excited about reading it. But what you're going to see happen is that Saul suddenly realizes that my son and my daughter keep telling David my plans, and that's why he's not going down. That's why I can't get rid of him. I mean, undermined by my own family. How is this even possible? And it all comes to head one night at dinner. And it wasn't just any dinner. It was the new moon festival. It was a couple nights of dinner with the king. The entire family was supposed to be here. This is the epic moment. If you don't make it to this, you're really slapping the king in the face. And of course, David doesn't come because he's been tipped off by his friend and his wife that dad is he's trying to get you. So David doesn't show up. And here's how this this meal took place. 1 Samuel chapter 20. That he realizes that his son and daughter have been tipping him off. And Saul boiled with rage in verse 30 and actually cussed at him. And after he cusses at him, he says, do you think I don't know that you want that you want David to be king in your place, shaming yourself and your mother? He's talking to Jonathan, his son. He's like, look, you are the one that's supposed to be the king, and you're just doing everything that you're doing is helping this guy become king. So obviously, that's what you want. And so here's what Saul says to his son. Well, as long as that son of Jesse's alive, you'll never be the king. If that's how you're going to play this, then here's the deal. I'll never let you become the king as long as that kid's alive. So bring David to me so I can kill him. So basically he's saying, you know, Jonathan, it's your game. You want to play this game with me? You just cost yourself your throne. Until David's alive, you don't get what you want. And so, man, what a mess this night was. And so Jonathan, he's like, well, Dad, what did he do, Dad? Why do you want to kill him so much? Everything that you ask him to do, he does for you. I paraphrase. Here it is, verse 32. Jonathan asked his father, but why should he be put to death? What has he done? And look what Saul did. He does exactly what he never dreamed in his life that he'd be capable of doing. But because of paranoia, jealousy, and anger, and insecurity, Saul hurled a spear at his own son, intending to kill him. Dude, that's heavy. Has your anger ever taken you to a place that you've done something that you wish you'd never done? I can remember growing up as a teenager. I remember I got in a really big fight with my dad. We just argued and argued, and then, you know, it got to be like one of those days where you're just like, I wish I could go back and do that again. And my dad and I have talked about it since. And we both just wish we could go back and not have that day in our story. This is one of those moments. You throw a spear at your son to kill him, that's a game changer in the relationship. Saul tries to kill his own son. So at last, Jonathan realized his father was really determined to kill David because his anger pushed him to do this. So yeah, if he's going to kill me, yeah, he's going to kill David. And it says in verse 34 that Jonathan left the table in fierce anger. He was broken, but listen to this. He was in fierce anger and refused to eat the second day of the festival. For he was crushed by his father's shameful behavior towards David. It broke him. Probably ran out of the room just crying in anger. And so Jonathan went and he tried to find David. He finally hunts David down. He says, listen, David, it's bad. Dad's not going to rest until you're dead. I'm sorry. You have to get out of the city. No, not just the city. You got to get out of the region. We can't go with you. There's nothing we can do because he's looking for you at every place. That means you can't go back home to your wife, your family. You can't go home with me, your friend. I can't protect you anymore because my dad's trying to kill me now because I'm trying to help you. And so I'm risking my life even being here. David, you have to get out of town. He's too threatened by you. Your reputation, your influence, your success. You got to go. And so suddenly, here it is. He's 22 years old. The giant slayer. The one that we all got so much courage out of, the one that we could just draw so much strength and faith from, suddenly is a 22-year-old guy who's had victory upon victory in the most impossible of battles, the one that has been in dangerous situations, looked death in the eye on multiple occasions and rose victorious. Suddenly, for the very first time in his life, he finds himself afraid. And he's done nothing wrong to deserve it. But he's now a wanted person with a bounty on his head. And it makes him really angry. Just like it would you. If you're treated unfairly by somebody and you didn't do anything wrong, not only is there something just wrong in our spirit, but we get super angry about that. It's a righteous anger. We didn't deserve this, but this is where David's at. He's afraid for his life. He's angry because he was rejected and abandoned. Lost his family, and now he's feeling alone. This loneliness is crippling to him. It's a rejection loneliness. It's an abandonment loneliness. I can't go home. I can't go to do the things I'm doing. What did I do wrong? He didn't do anything wrong. And he did what we all are tempted to do when we're facing moments where we're afraid, when we face moments when we're angry, when we feel moments when we're rejected or lonely. He panicked. He freaked out, and he lost sight of the fact that God was with him. David, he knew that God was with him in all occasions. Suddenly, because of these emotions, he forgets that God's with him. He forgets that God fights for him. And so he decided to do what you and I do when we face these moments, is that we figure that God must not be with me if this is happening to me. And so therefore, God's ways and God's laws must not apply in this situation. I'm going to have to take matters into my own hands and do things that are out of character. But here goes nothing. And we step into that dangerous place. And we can't help but think to ourselves, come on, David, what are you doing, man? You're David. You're going to be King David. We know the rest of his story. So it's easier for you and I to look at this story and just say, man, you're blowing it, man. You're going to regret this one day, you know? But I can't help but think that there's some people in the room that right now there's people looking at your life and your situation, and they're seeing you under fear and loneliness or rejection or abandonment or insecurity or paranoia or jealousy, talking about and contemplating live options in your situation that are bad for you. And people are looking at you going, aren't you a Christian? Why are you here? You don't normally hang out with us. You don't normally do these things. And they're looking at you in your situation, and they're saying, I thought you had a different story. From what I know about you, this isn't a place that you need to be. And let's be honest, you and I can all look back at dark seasons of our lives where our emotions have gotten the best of us, and we ended up in places that we never dreamed that we would be in. And you found yourself looking back now at that situation, and you say these things like, what was I thinking? Why did I go there? Why did I call her back? Why did I let him come over? Why did I agree to try that? Why did I borrow that money? The list just goes on, but there's something in you that these emotions allowed you to reach further than you thought was possible. The answer is pretty straightforward, why you did it. You were controlled by your emotions, and it took you and drew you into doing something that you would greatly regret later in life. And the same thing happened to David. In this case, he panics, and it leads him to the most disastrous and greatest mistake of his life, and here's how it began. It doesn't seem like it's so bad when it starts, but it has a disastrous outcome. 1 Samuel chapter 21, David went to the town of Nob to see Ahimelech the priest. So just pause there so you know where Nob is and what this is all about. Is that the kingdom has their first king, and that's Saul. It's not really developed yet. I mean, Saul's been in leadership for a while, but the Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle, it was moved from place to place wherever it was safest. And so at this particular time, the Ark of the Covenant and the Tabernacle were in a city called Nob, and Ahimelech was the high priest, the chief priest, and he was the one responsible for, you know, the sacrifices and all the things that would take place in the Tabernacle. And so Ahimelech was here, and this is where David, you know, he's running, he's panicked, he's on the run. So verse 1, David went to the town of Nob to see Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech, look what happened when he saw him. Ahimelech, who knows David very well, he trembles when he saw him. He's like, David, why are you alone? Why is no one with you? He's like kind of freaking out. This isn't normal. This is weird because, David, you travel with an entourage. And typically where David shows up with his entourage, there's bloodshed. David's on a mission. There's always something he's up to for the king. It's good stuff. But, I mean, David, I mean, I've counseled with him. I know him. He's never alone. Something's wrong. And that should have been his first clue. And listen to what David says in verse 2. David, who's running from the king, says this. Well, hey, Ahimelech, the king has sent me on a private matter. So he told me not to tell anyone why I'm here. And I've told my men to meet me later. What? You're on a private mission? Yeah, I'm on a private mission. That's what I'm doing. David lies. Think about this. David, he was pushed by these emotions of fear and loneliness and anger to a place that he's on the run, and now, and he's with the person who he knows he would counsel with God with, the one that he could go, and he's done before. He's counseled with him on behalf of God to get direction and guidance for his life. He's now face to face with the one who can intercede and help him communicate with God at this moment in time, and he lies to him about his intent to be there. What's even more profound is that, David knows, he's a very smart person. He knows the Ten Commandments, right? He knows thou shalt not what? Lie, right? And so think about this, the Ten Commandments sit in the Ark of the Covenant, which is probably 30 steps away from where he's standing. The original document that says thou shalt not lie. But David pushes past the relationship he has with Ahimelech, and he lies to him because he's afraid. He feels abandoned. He doesn't know who he can trust. And so he lies. But sadly, this lie would lead to a disastrous outcome, not for David, but for the one he's lying to, Ahimelech. He took matters into his own hands. But it continues, verse 3, he says, and now what is there to eat? Can you give me like 5 loaves of bread? Or do you have anything else I can have? And he begins to kind of ask for food. So Ahimelech's like, okay, wait a minute. You're alone. You're the king's son-in-law. You're a champion warrior on a special mission. You look like you haven't slept in days. You're a wreck. And you're asking for food for me. All I have here is consecrated bread, which is the bread that's put on the altar for God. And then we refresh it all the time. And then the priests, we eat this consecrated bread. So the only people that can eat this are ceremonially clean people. And are you ceremonially clean? But I guess you can have it. And David's like, yeah, we're good. We're all good. We're all ceremonially clean. We'll take what you got. And so he takes the bread, just keeping the lie going. And then this next question, if that doesn't just like mess with Ahimelech's brain, this next question must really have been the icing on the cake, as David says to him in verse 8. Now David asked Ahimelech, do you have like a spear or a sword or something? I don't really care which one it is, as long as it's got a really sharp point on it and something I can, just like poke people with, because the king's business was so urgent that day when he sent me, I didn't have time to grab my weapon. Like, what? This just reeks of like the worst lie in history, doesn't it? If your kid was telling you this lie, you wouldn't believe it. You'd spank him right there on the spot. You're like, you're just lying to me. Go to your room. This is kind of what's happening. And so Ahimelech, though, but he's trusting David. Why? Because of his position. He's trusting David because of his influence. He's trusting David because of his track record and his power. And this is the guy here. You're just going to take it at face value. So Ahimelech is doing nothing wrong. Are you catching me? He's doing nothing wrong but just trying to meet the needs of the one that he has respect in and trust for. But didn't make sense. And so he's like, well, I do have a sword. And this is the moment in time where I think that if you could just pause like the movie, right, and add the strings and just cue the drama moment and slow everything down a little bit. This is the moment that David's going to come face to face with, I believe, God shouting to him saying, I'm with you and I will fight for you. I know you're afraid. I know you feel abandoned. I know you're lonely. I know you're angry, but I am with you and I will fight for you just like I did when you stood there in the valley of Elah with thousands of eyes looking at you, waiting for you to get crushed by a giant, and you stood there with confidence in heaven's armies that I was going to fight for you. I'm still here with you and I'm still fighting for you. So what could I show you, David, that would just be a kind of a shout out from heaven that I'm with you by giving you the biggest and best reminder I know how to do? You need a sword, by the way. We have a sword, and it's the sword of Goliath, the Philistines, who you killed in the valley of Elah. That's the sword we have here. It's wrapped up in an ephod in the back. If you want it, you can have it. There's nothing else here. Think about the gravity of that moment. The only sword available to David during this crucial moment of David's life was the sword that represented God's past faithfulness and would serve as the biggest reminder that God would fight for David. The last time that this sword was being used, it was in the hand of a giant that was defeated by a 15-year-old boy. And that 15-year-old boy was you, David. And you stepped in the way because your king was terrified and couldn't face this giant. And now the very person who was terrified by the king, by the giant that you killed, now you're running from and you're afraid. Don't you think for a minute that you're alone, because I am with you. Can you imagine the drama of that moment? This should have been that moment where David's like, oh my goodness, the sword of Goliath. Okay, I get it. I get it. What am I doing here? I need to go back. I don't have to run. Why am I lying? Why am I so afraid? It should be the moment that David remembers that the Lord will fight for him, but he doesn't. He misses it. And I'm sure he thought, God ain't with me, because all this stuff wouldn't be happening to me. And instead of making things better, David makes things worse by lying. And the same thing's true for all of us. That these emotions, no matter what they are, and these are just six we're talking about today, but there's so many more emotions that when they come into play, they have the power to make us forget all the giants that we have previously defeated that God was with us for. And we somehow think this one's bigger, this one God can't do anything about, and we decide to take matters into our own hands. God gave David this amazing visual reminder, and David missed it. I wonder if he's given you any visual reminders in your life of previous giants he's fought, and now you're afraid of the one that's facing you. David says in verse 9, the sword, there's nothing like it. Give it to me. And this decision, just like all of our decisions, would become a permanent part of David's story. A decision that would soon become one of David's deepest regrets. And just like our decisions that we make in times of emotional crisis, when we're afraid or insecure or jealous or angry, those decisions become our deepest regrets and a permanent part of our story as well. For David, this decision would end up with the death of Ahimelech and a dangerous, disastrous outcome. And this is where our story intersects with us. This is where this story in the Bible just comes right into us. Why is it that when it seems like you and I need to rely the most on God, that we're most apt to rely on our own selves and take matters into our own hands? Why is it that we can push past his laws, his precepts, his ways, and the things that we know as believers, and choose to put things into our court and chase after things that have never worked out before for us, and run to things or run to people that we know that we'd be better off leaving alone, or finding refuge in things that we know that will just likely end in regret? We don't lean on God, we lean on ourselves, and we lean on these things. And you know it's true because you've done it. And you know it's true because you see other people do it. Right now, you probably have someone in your life right now who's making terrible decisions in the midst of an emotional crisis. And when you see him do it, you're just thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe they just made that choice. I can't believe they just chose to go here tonight. I know they're stressed out about all that's going on, but they're going to the clubs with their friends, and that's not going to go well. So easy to see in other people, isn't it? When they're making these bad mistakes. But it is almost virtually impossible for us to see this in the mirror. And why is that? I'll tell you why. It's because somehow or another, when you and I are in the midst of these emotional crises, we try to convince ourselves that our situation is different. What our friends are going through and all that, it's not that. What's happening to me right now is different. It's unique. It's special. But unfortunately, I don't know how to say this in any other way. I don't mean to be harsh when I say that, but listen, you may be a unique person, but your situation is not unique. You may be a special person, but this is not a special situation. This is not a special circumstance. You may be a one-of-a-kind, unique person, but this is not a unique circumstance. You know why? Because these things are all well-worn paths of humanity. Somehow or another, in the human condition, in times of emotional crisis, through paranoia, insecurity, jealousy, anger, fear, loneliness, rejection, abandonment, and all those super high, just emotional moments, humans make the same stupid mistakes over and over again. You can see it in other people because it's common to all people. Your situation is not unique. Don't try to justify it or say that. These are well-worn paths. That's why it's so easy to see in others. So David's on the run. Where does he go? I'm just going to give you the context of the story because it kind of plays into the end of the story. David goes to run. He's on the run, and the first thing he does is he decides to go to the land of the Philistines. You know, when you're already got some stupid decisions, right, you just make another dumb decision, right? The land of the Philistines, isn't that the enemy? Yeah, and it's worse than that. He goes to the city of Gath. Guess who's from Gath? Goliath. So he's got, what was he holding? Goliath's sword. He's going into enemy territory, taunting the family of the giant he killed. And he just kind of walks in there and finds himself in front of King Achish, and Scripture gives us a little bit of information of what happened there, but it appears that David's trying to kind of maybe make an ally arrangement with him and kind of say, hey, we'll fight together. You know, Saul wants to kill me, and I want to kill him now, and so can we? And then eventually the king says, wait a minute, dude, you're David. And all of a sudden David realizes that he is not welcomed here and that they're all saying, you're David, you're a mighty warrior, what are you doing here? And they begin to get worried. The tables are turning and things are escalating on David. So David figures out his goose is cooked if he doesn't do something quick. And so King David, strong, mighty, powerful king, I mean, not calling him a king, he's not a king yet. David, this character that we know is this courageous person on the run, he decides to act crazy. He actually spits all over himself. It's kind of funny, I started the message by spitting all over myself. That's full circle. He's like spitting all over himself, and he's dragging his hands all over the doors and the walls and just acting like a madman. Finally, the king says, I got enough crazy people in my court. Just get this guy out of here. And David, fortunately, his life is spared. God protects him in that moment because he was in dangerous, dangerous situation. And so he flees from there, and he goes and lives in a cave, alone, afraid, rejected, abandoned, still full of anger, and he stays in that cave until eventually he decides to consult with a prophet, a man of God, and he says, what am I supposed to do? And the guy says, go home. Go back to Judah. You weren't supposed to run. And so David goes home, and word gets back to Saul that David's on his way, and Saul feels like David's on his way to kill him because he's paranoid and insecure and jealous and all those things. And so David doesn't realize that he's getting ready to have another confrontation coming up, but here's the big thing. Is that David thinks that maybe things are on the mend and things are going to get better on his way home. But what he doesn't realize is things are actually just getting worse. That lie that he told is playing itself out in a really bad way. And here's how the story goes. Is that there was somebody else there that day when King David was with Ahimelech. When he was with Ahimelech asking for bread and for a sword and for those things, there was someone else eavesdropping on the conversation. His name was Doeg. And Doeg would be the one who would just hear just enough of the story and see just enough of the details that when he goes back and tells the king about this, it would be just enough to really make it look bad for Ahimelech. And so he goes back to to King Saul and he says, listen, when I was in Nob, I actually saw David. And he was, you know, your high priest, the one that you like trust with everything. Unfortunately, I got some bad news. He sided with David. I actually watched him give him food. And you know what? He gave him, he armed him too. He gave him the sword of Goliath of all things. He's fully in his court and he's assisting him. This is how the conversation went in verse 9 of chapter 22. Then Doeg the Edomite, who was standing there with Saul's men, spoke up. He says, when I was at Nob, I saw the son of Jesse talking to the priest Ahimelech. And Ahimelech consulted the Lord for him. And then he gave him food and the sword of Goliath, the Philistines. And Saul immediately was furious. He sent out for Ahimelech and his family. And when they arrived, Saul shouted at them. He says, listen to me. And he just gets ready to blast them. And Ahimelech says, what is it, my king? What's going on? Why are we here? What's happening? And Saul begins to explain to him, you've conspired against me. Why did you give food and a sword to David? Why did you consult God for him? Why have you encouraged him to kill me as he's trying to do this very day? And Ahimelech's like, time out. I didn't, you got this wrong, sir. Respectfully, I didn't do any of that. Is there any one of your servants as faithful as David? I mean, this is your guy. This is the one that everyone knows does your bidding. He is loyal to you. Is there anyone more loyal than David? Why? He's the captain of your bodyguard and the highly honored member of your household. This was certainly not the first time I consulted with him. He's come here before. I know him. Whatever he needs, I always do for him. May the king not accuse me and my family of this matter. I don't know anything about a plot against you. He's just standing here going, okay, it was really weird when he showed up on your little secret mission you had him go do, but I didn't. And he's like thinking, oh my gosh. You can just tell like Ahimelech's realizing, David lied to me. There's something really major going on. I knew there was something there. And so verse 16, King Saul says something I know that he never dreamed that he would ever say. But because he was paranoid, insecure, and jealous, these emotions pushed him to do something that he never planned ever to do in his life. Remember how respectful King Saul was to Samuel the priest? Saul had a high level of respect of the authority of the position of the priest because they knew that they connected with God. And suddenly his rage, his anger, his insecurity and jealousy pushed past all of that head knowledge and decided, I'm taking matters into my own hands. Heck with you, God. And I'm going to kill the priest. And so this is what he says. You will surely die, Ahimelech, along with your entire family. I'm not going to stop with just you. I'm going to kill everybody. And then he ordered his bodyguards. He said to all the men that were there, kill the priest, for they're the allies and conspirators with David. They knew he was running away from me, but they didn't tell me. But Saul's men, they're like, I'm not killing the priest. We're not like, no. This is really uncomfortable. These are the priests. And so then verse 18, then the king said to Doeg, that guy that was bucking for the job and the opportunity, and said, hey, I'm going to tattle on your guy. He turns to Doeg and says, you do it. You kill him. And so Doeg the Edomite turned on all of them and killed them all that day. 85 people in all, still wearing their priestly garment. Just imagine what that looks like to see all the priests just killed and slaughtered in the temple, I mean, in the palace. But he wasn't done. The king sent Doeg next to Nob. Then he went to Nob, the town of the priest, and killed all the priest's family, the men and the women, the children, the babies, and all the cattle, the donkeys, the sheep, and the goats. Scripture tells us that only one person got away that on record, and that was the son of Ahimelech, Abithar. And Abithar would escape and find David, and he would throw himself down at David's feet, and he would just tell him everything had happened. And as he was describing what's happened to Ahimelech and his family, what King Saul said, David would realize, it was my lie that did this. And here it was, David was crushed, and he was broken with incredible deep regret and shame. And he says, and he has to look in the eye of the only survivor in the family, and he says these words, I am responsible for the death of your entire family. Can you imagine? Not just his entire family, but his entire village. A village was killed because David chose to lie. A village was killed because David forgot, in the midst of his high emotional situation, He forgot that God was with him and that God would fight for him, and he took matters into his own hands, and it had a disastrous outcome. And that's what happens to you and I when we take our situations into our own hands. Sure, sometimes it feels good to take matters into our own hands, but hear me clearly, it just doesn't turn out good. And so for Christians here today, facing whatever it is right now that's got you emotionally amped up, you are in danger right now of crossing a threshold of what you know and have confidence about God being with you to step into doing something that you will later regret and has the potential to be one of your greatest regrets. Because at some point in all of our lives, our anger is going to push us and taunt us to do that type of thing. At some point in time, your loneliness could get you to begin fantasizing about something that you never believed would be possible, that you would say that would be morally something that you would never do, and suddenly it's becoming a live option for you right now in your context. And this happens because these emotions are just so stinking powerful. So let me ask you 3 or 4 questions, then we're going to go home. Just thinking questions, and then we're going to have the band sing one song, and we're going to go home. The question is this: what is your loneliness or your anger or your fear causing you to consider right now that you never would have considered ever before? Relationally, financially, physically. Maybe there's some risk that you're willing to take that you never thought you'd take again. Maybe you're contemplating starting an old habit that you spent weeks and months and money to try to get away from, but now because of what's happening in your life right now, suddenly you feel like just kind of toying with it again, hoping it'll make things feel better. But it'll just simply wrap itself around you. A giant that God's already conquered that you're willing to come running back to for some type of aid. What about this question? Who has your loneliness or your anger or your fear caused you to consider that you know that you should have stayed away from them? You know, you shouldn't have called him back, but now you're considering calling him back. She's called you over and over and over again, and you never called back, but now you're thinking, today's the day I might give her a call. She's made it really clear that there's a potential for a relationship. He's made it really clear that he's interested in you, but you've always been able to kind of push past that. It's a flattering thing, but you've always been able to push past it. But right now, because of what's happening in your family, what's happening in your finances, what's happening in your job or some other area of your life, suddenly the idea of a relationship with this person seems like a real option. You got to run. Maybe you've never dreamed about experimenting in a type of relationship that you thought would just not be something you'd ever consider, but because you're alone right now, you're thinking, maybe it's an option. These emotions have the power to do things to us we never thought possible. My third question is, who besides you would this decision impact? Because right now I know you don't care about yourself in the midst of the crisis. It's you're in self-preservation mode. But who besides you has to pay the consequences for your decision when you act in this way? And I can already tell you the answer to that question. The answer is simply this: the people that you love the most and the people who love you the most, those are the ones that suffer the consequences. But you probably already know that. You probably have experience with this already in your life. That one night that your dad's anger got the best of him and blew up, and you're still cleaning up the pieces from that. Maybe your mom was so lonely and felt so rejected or abandoned that all of a sudden she decided to go out and have a new relationship, and that relationship ended up in a divorce, and you as kids have been picking up the pieces trying to figure out how to do holidays, how to handle life in this new normal, and it's not normal and it's breaking your heart. You try to keep the peace with the family. You're caught in the middle of it. You know what it's like to be the victim of the decision that someone else made. The list just goes on. Maybe you're a teenager and you discover that you're pregnant and you were so afraid and you felt so abandoned and you didn't want to feel rejected by your parents, and so you made the decision to do something you never thought possible. And you made an appointment at an abortion clinic. And now you're haunted by a cry of unborn life in your heart. is asking God to do some type of redemptive work in you. And he will. He can forgive. He can heal. But I just want to remind you, there's a real pain associated with that. My last question, and then our time is up. We got to go. We're still going to sing our final song because I really want it to minister to your heart. It's such a powerful song. But what advice would you give someone right now that's facing your situation? I know that you can't see it. I know it's hard for you to see. But if someone that you knew was facing this situation, what would you say to them? Because that person needs to talk to you. You got to somehow pull yourself out of the emotional mire and remember this is a well-worn path. What would you tell someone who is you what to do in this situation? If King David could come back and talk to you, he would speak to you personally, but instead he wrote you many, many Psalms and Proverbs to help us. And in the Psalms chapter 9, he would remind us that the Lord is our refuge and our strength and that we run to him in times of trouble. In our emotional distress, we run to God and he will protect us. He will help us and he will guide us. Jesus himself, 1,000 years after that, in the city of David, Jesus himself being a descendant of David, would stand in front of an entire nation of people who were afraid. And he would say to them, "Come to me, all you who are weak and heavy burdened and heavy laden, full of loneliness and anger and jealousy and fear, come to me, bring it all, and I will give you rest." And so this morning, if you don't know Jesus Christ, I pray that you won't leave today without asking him to be your Lord and your Savior, your forgiver and your leader. Our prayer team is going to be in all four corners of the room as we sing this final song. But it's my prayer that today, if you don't have a personal relationship with God, come talk with one of us in the corner. We want to help you know what it means to put your faith and trust in God, to have the confidence that he's fighting for you and fighting with you in whatever your life seems to throw at you. Let me pray for you. Father, thank you for this morning. Thank you for the power of your word. I pray right now that you would use this message and this song, Lord, to encourage the hearts of those that are here to remember that even though they're going through a storm, it is temporary. It's only for a moment that you are fighting for us and you're causing everything to work together for our good. For it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Let's stand together and sing.
Jesus, please. Sunday, everyone.